From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Many colleges and universities have expanded their distance learning programs. How do local distance learning institutions stay competitive? We asked the president of University of Maryland University College, fighting to hold on to its claim as America's largest online public university. Then doctors at Johns Hopkins Bayview's multidisciplinary cancer clinic have developed an approach to fighting cancer that puts the patient in the driver's seat. We talk with them about how it changes treatment. Plus, writer Azar Nafisi talks with Tom Hall about the role of fiction beyond just telling a good story.
These novels not only reflect the kind of reality that we live in, but they are also sort of like our moral guardians.
First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Distance learning is arguably the wave of the future in higher education. More and more students are choosing courses or entire degree programs that don't require them to show up in class, to listen to lectures and take tests, but to learn course material and interact with their professors online. In Maryland, distance learning also has a venerable past. For decades, University of Maryland University College, UMUC, dominated distance learning globally, offering classes at more than 100 U.S. military installations and in more than 20 countries around the world. Now, UMUC is scrambling to hold on to students who have many more options for distance learning. This month, the president of the University of Maryland University College, Javier Millares, told UMUC stakeholders he has ruled out a recommendation from an outside panel to turn UMUC into a nonprofit. But UMUC is going ahead with plans to change its business model. The framework of the new plans includes increasing enrollment of out-of-state residents by creating a board of military, business, and academic leaders. Also, UMUC wants to be exempt from certain state policies that affect how public agencies perform functions like procurement and human resources. It contends it needs to compete with other schools not bound by such rules. When I spoke with President Millares last summer, I asked why University of Maryland University College needs to make changes.
Let's talk a little bit about our history so we can understand our present. We started in 1947, and from the very beginning, we are about one of the few institutions that from the beginning, our sole mission was to educate working adults. 1947. From the beginning, we never had a physical campus. And we were founded to serve the returning veterans. We grew overseas. We went to serve the military. We were the only institution willing to do that. And we grew and developed online and became the largest online university, as you pointed out. In the mid-90s, when we went with online, we were about the only institution doing that. But then in the last 15 years, as was pointed out before, many other institutions went into that space. Some of them the for-profit institutions, but now we see some of the large public institutions like Penn State, the University of Florida just came out with University of Florida Online, moving into the working adult space. So the competition for us has increased tremendously.
And your enrollment has gone down
and
in the last couple of years.
As a result of that competition, and because we half of our students are military, because of the impact of the federal budget, our enrollments have declined over the last 2 years.
Well, UMUC was early, as you said, going back to 1947, it was early to structure its offerings according to what employers said they needed in workers, particularly the U.S. military. Yeah. It was early to get to use the internet to offer yeah. courses online. And then it seemed to sort of just stop competing effectively. Why was that? That was sort of like, I guess, in the 90s.
I think it's a very natural reaction for many organizations. They are very successful, and they think they will be successful forever doing the same thing. So you sort of rest on your laurels. And when you have, when you are one of the largest player in the online space, there is an assumption, there was an assumption that you would always be, no matter what. So it was complacency, as a matter of fact, that there was a complacency that will always be the largest provider.
And now you're looking at making UMUC a not-for-profit business entity. What does that mean?
Basically, it means the options that we have to go back to growth, and growth is very important to us. Volume, in online volume, allows you to provide high quality at low cost. That's the model. High quality, low cost, you need volume. When we start declining, we have to do something about it. We realize that Maryland is a small state. Our footprint is Maryland and the military. Maryland is a small state. The military is shrinking. So we look into the future and we realize we have to expand our footprint nationally. It is very difficult to do so as a state agency.
Why?
State agencies, by nature and rightly, are more regulated because they have a lot of taxpayer money. And they are more geared to simply do one very specific thing in the state. In our case, we get very little state support. And being regulated like if we are a state entity actually would impede us in moving into the national market beyond Maryland, and not just the national market, but the international market. Is the flexibility needed? Something as simple as getting procurement, a marketing contract. It takes us about a year to get a marketing contract. You cannot wait 1 year. And that's just an example of having to be more flexible, more agile, that you can actually be by just being a state unit.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Javier Millares, president of the University of Maryland University College. We're talking about restructuring ideas that UMUC is considering. UMUC is also talking about an emphasis on competency-based education, as I understand it, looking at what students can prove they know rather than what classes they've taken. Briefly, how would that work?
This is the exciting part, because now we're talking about really how we serve best our students. Let's assume that you have been working as an accountant, a bookkeeper in an accounting firm. You have learned a lot about the field, but you have not taken courses. So we can ask you, look, if you show us that you really have mastered some basic principles of accounting, why do you have to take a course that is going to teach what you already know? That's one part of competency-based education. Another part of competency-based education is when you have courses that are very clearly, with very clearly defined learning outcomes, if I can give you the resources, the content that you can study in your own, that you can conduct your work, you can do your work, academic work, at your own pace, at your own time, why should I bring you into the strict setting of a course that you have to attend, and perhaps for you it's better to do it in your own with mentoring from a faculty, so then you can study it at your own pace, at your own time. For some students, that will be shorter. For some students, it may take longer. So basically, competency-based education, at the end of the day, it means what matters is what you have learned, not how or when you learned it.
And are you confident that you can actually test well enough to know what a student knows?
I am confident that we can assess what students know. It is not generally would not be done via tests. It will be done by projects.
Okay.
For instance, you're taking a business class. The project may be build a business plan for a
gotcha.
New.
We have just a minute left, and I want to make sure I ask you this idea of restructuring.
Yeah.
Where does it stand? What happens next?
At this point, the idea is out for the UMUC community to provide feedback. This was the recommendation of a group of external business leaders. That recommendation came to me. They appointed them. Now the whole university community is commenting on it. At the end, in the next 2 months, I will have a recommendation to the regents and the chancellor. They will decide.
I appreciate you explaining it to us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure to be here.
Javier Millares is president of University of Maryland University College. We spoke in August when the option of turning UMUC into a nonprofit was still being debated. That is no longer part of the restructuring plan that is expected to go to the University System of Maryland Board of Regents in the next few months, and possibly to the Maryland General Assembly when the legislative session begins in January. Another recent development, after several years of declining enrollments, UMUC enrolled 5% more students in the U.S. this fall than last year, 3% more worldwide. We have more information about UMUC and its restructuring on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, getting the input of patients in decisions about treating their cancer. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. A diagnosis of esophageal cancer or lung cancer or other cancer of the chest sends a patient and her family down a long, difficult, and sometimes lonely and scary road. Such cancers often grow unnoticed, so by the time they're found, the prognosis is poor. About 2 years ago, Johns Hopkins Bayview reorganized how it approaches chest cancers to confront the cancer with a wide view of how to treat it and to include the patient as part of that treatment team. Here's how Dr. Daniela Molina, a surgical oncologist on the team of physicians at the Kimmel Cancer Center's Thoracic Oncology Multidisciplinary Clinic, described its approach in a video Johns Hopkins produced.
We meet as a team, so thoracic surgeons, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, pathologists, radiologists, we all together evaluate the patient's history, the patient's x-rays and CT scans, and we all discuss what is the best treatment for that patient in particular. There are a lot of possibility for treatment. There is never really one option. And so it's very important to look at every single patient like a unique case.
With me to tell us more about lung cancer and the multidisciplinary clinic's approach is its director, Dr. Russell Hales, assistant professor of radiation oncology and molecular radiation sciences at Johns Hopkins. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
And also with us is the clinic's coordinator, nurse practitioner Peggy Lang, who has cared for lung and esophageal cancer patients at Johns Hopkins for more than 20 years. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Dr. Hales, why is it such a big deal assembling all the doctors around the table at the same time?
Well, as was said by Dr. Molina, the treatment of tumors like lung cancer is very complex. And getting the right stakeholders in the room together, that is, getting the key people who will make decisions to discuss individual patients, is going to help those patients to do better. And that's why it's important that we bring that team together.
Do they actually come up with different ideas when they're all sitting together looking at one patient's records?
Well, we all have different ways of approaching things, but the point is to bring those together to do what's right for the patient. And so, yes, what we find happens is that when you put 15 or 20 or 25 physicians and other providers in a room together to talk about individual patients, there's an energy there, there's an excitement there about how we can best treat a patient. What we found over time in this clinic is that the way that we approach these tumors becomes a lot more predictable. So certainly we look at the individual features of each patient to make a decision on how to best treat them. What happened when I started at the Johns Hopkins Hospital as a faculty member was that patients would often come to see me some 2, 3, 4 weeks after they had initially gotten into the hospital to be seen. And by the time that they moved down that pathway of seeing multiple providers, time had passed. Usually the plan that was put forward would be initiated by the first doctor that saw the patient. But as time went on, there was a chance for the patient's tumor to grow. If providers 4 weeks in wanted to make changes in terms of how the patient would be managed, there was already a path set forward. By bringing everybody together on day one, we can collaborate and come up with a unified plan on how to proceed. I think what we do is we have unified protocols, but then we find the unique exceptions and we apply those as a unified team together.
Peggy Lang, I don't think I had realized how time-sensitive these decisions are, how mm-hmm. important it is to move quickly. Why so time-sensitive?
It isn't just the patient's anxiety. I mean, obviously, if somebody's told they have lung cancer, they want to get started as soon as possible. They want things to happen tomorrow. And unfortunately, there's a lot of testing that a patient needs to go through, so we have a very clear understanding exactly where the cancer has spread in the body. Because lung cancer can spread without a patient having any symptoms, often it can be more advanced the day a patient finds out they have it. And so there are other tests that have to happen. And that in itself can be anxiety provoking to the patient, just that we have more things to do one after another after another. But lung cancer is also critical that we start a treatment as quickly as we can. Lung cancers progress more quickly. The being located in the chest, near the airways, near the heart, near the vocal cords, the esophagus, complications that occur there can be life-threatening.
So how quickly does it happen in your clinic?
Ideally within a week. That when I receive a referral, I can arrange the other tests within the next few days. So by the time the patient comes to the Multi-D clinic, the doctors there have all the information they need to get the treatment started. Assuming the patient agrees and wants to move forward, their next appointment is often the next day or 2 days later.
Now, just this month, Medicare announced it will pay for lung cancer screening, CAT scans,
yay,
for people at high risk of cancer, essentially people who have smoked a lot. Dr. Hales, do you expect that screening to make a difference in the patients you'll be seeing?
The reason that that test was approved is because it was shown that in screening patients that were at high risk for lung cancer, as you said, patients who have smoked a lot or are currently smoking, that by screening them with a CT scan, that we could decrease the chance of patients dying from lung cancer by 20%. So we do anticipate that if this test is used in a more widespread manner in the community, that we can better pick up cancers earlier and increase the chance of curing them.
That's Dr. Russell Hales, a radiation oncologist who directs the Lung Cancer Multidisciplinary Clinic at Johns Hopkins Bayview. Here on Maryland Morning on 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. Also here is nurse practitioner Peggy Lang, coordinator of the Lung Cancer Multidisciplinary Program, the Lung Cancer Screening Clinic, and the Pulmonary Nodule Clinic. Peggy Lang, how does it change things to call the patient part of the treatment team?
I think the trend in medicine overall in America is moving to patient-centered care. Patients want to be part of the decision-making. They don't want a doctor to just tell them what to do. They want to be able to ask intelligent questions, to be part of the team. And with us, that's absolutely the case. There are treatments we may recommend that a patient just doesn't want to tolerate, whether they have a family member with a past history of something, whether they have just an emotional issue, a spiritual, religious issue against something, for something. Now, granted, we're going to give our recommendation and educate the patient on why we feel this is the best treatment. If a patient refuses or asks something else, then we modify, because, you know, we're not going to cure cancer by recommending something that a patient won't follow through. They are the key player of the team.
I want to hear another brief clip that Dr. Daniela Molina made in that video we heard earlier.
Every cancer is, depending on the stage, can be treated differently, and we want to be as aggressive as possible to give patients a better chance for survival.
As aggressive as possible. Dr. Hales, do you find that's what most patients want?
Well, as Peggy mentioned, every patient has a different philosophy, a different view. We all come in with different life experiences, and our role is not to dictate a treatment plan, but first to ask questions about a patient's goals and wishes. You're right, we do find that patients, generally speaking, want to be as aggressive as they safely can be. But what we first start by doing is asking them what their goals and wishes are.
Dr. Hales, does the multidisciplinary approach that you take change the outcomes of your patients as a group?
Well, we see a little over 200 patients a year in this setting. And we've shown that when we compare the patients who come through the program since we started versus those who came through before we started the program, that we're decreasing the amount of time it takes to come from entering Hopkins to starting therapy by about 35%. What that means is that patients are starting therapy quicker. What that means is that we're fighting tumors even more quickly and increasing their chance of curing their disease.
I want listeners to hear from another member of your team, Dr. Christine Hahn, who's a medical oncologist.
We don't have all the answers to which patient will be a long-term survivor of cancer, but our hope is that every patient we meet, especially at the multi-D clinic, that we can offer them a treatment plan that will provide them a really good quality of life for as long as possible.
Peggy Lash, how do you deal with that transition when it doesn't look like this patient is going to be cured?
I think it's important to focus again on the patient's goals. So we understand with the prognosis of lung cancer, there is a small percentage of patients that we can cure. But for those that we can't cure, quality of life is the most important goal. So we want to treat the patient and, as we say, kick the can down the road as far as possible. But that means that the patient also has quality of life. We want to manage their pain. We want to manage their shortness of breath. We want to improve their fatigue. And so even if we're not treating with an intent to cure, if we're treating with palliation, that is also meeting the patient's goals.
How many patients are you caring for at any given time?
We have approximately 4 to 6 that come every week through the multi-D clinic. Once they start on treatment, then they're really under the care of Dr. Hales and the medical oncologist or the surgeon. So we've had about 200 patients through the program that are in some phase of treatment or surveillance at this point.
Dr. Hales, is this multidisciplinary approach something that other hospitals which don't have Johns Hopkins financial backing could afford to do, or does it just take too many resources?
Well, that's a great question, and it's worth saying that this isn't just what we're doing in the lung program. It's also what we're doing in other disease sites, other cancers. We're doing this in prostate cancer, in pancreatic cancer, in breast cancer, so that we can improve the patient experience. It'll be a necessity that other programs take on this patient-centered role with multidisciplinary programs. It is resource-intensive up front, but what we're finding is that we're not only getting better outcomes for our patients, but they're having a better experience.
Does it take any change in normal reimbursement practices by insurers to cover this approach to treatment?
No, there's not a change in that. If anything, we find that we can do things more efficiently. You can envision that if a patient sees one provider or doctor, and has a set of tests done, and then another one who wants another set of tests, and then a third who wants yet another set, that's inefficient and it's time intensive. If you can bring them all to the table and have them discuss and work together to come up with a plan, you'll actually end up getting fewer tests and a more streamlined approach for the patient.
Peggy Lang, what do you hear from patients about this approach?
They love it. I think the biggest response we hear is nobody spent the time to sit down and talk with me and answer my questions. Nobody explained this to me. Now I understand. And even though it's still frightening information to hear, they see that we work together as a team and they're part of that team.
Thank you for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Russell Hales, Assistant Professor of Radiation Oncology and Molecular Radiation Sciences, directs the Lung Cancer Multidisciplinary Clinic at Johns Hopkins Bayview. He's also involved in development of the Lung Cancer Center of Excellence. Nurse practitioner Peggy Lang, coordinator of the Lung Cancer Multidisciplinary Program, has been caring for cancer patients at Johns Hopkins for two decades. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/MarylandMorning. Including a link to a video about the multidisciplinary clinic created by Laurie Singer. I'm Sheila Cass. This is Maryland Morning. Just ahead, novelist Azar Nafisi. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/MarylandMorning.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. 10 years ago, the Iranian-American author Azar Nafisi wrote a memoir called Reading Lolita in Tehran. That book sold more than 1 million copies, and it was hailed as a powerful testament to literature's unique potential in Iran's closed society. In her latest book, Dr. Nafisi examines the role of novels in American culture by looking at three important works of fiction and discussing how and why the stories that we encounter in literature are so important to our democracy. The book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. Azar Nafisi will be reading from her book next week at the Ivy Bookshop, and this morning she joins us from her home in Washington, D.C., with, I'm unfortunately required to report, a terrible cold. Dr. Nafisi, good morning. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for giving us your time, even though you are under the weather. You note right at the top of this book the possibility of a connection between income inequality and what you describe as the growing lack of respect for ideas and imagination. And then a little bit later in the book, you refer to the assault on literature that's going on in the United States. Why do you sense that there is an attack on literature in this, the Republic of Imagination?
Well, I think that the what I call the attack on literature is in an indirect manner an attack also on the kind of reality we're living under. That's why I was talking about, the kind of each society, whether it is democratic or totalitarian, is based on certain values, principles, and ideas. And when those principles and ideas are neglected, I think that then both reality and fiction become sort of threatened and endangered. And this is how I feel about America right now, that especially among our elite, there's this culture that is taking out of our system of education, for example. You notice that art and music and poetry are taken out of most public schools, and that the blame for what is happening in education is mainly placed on the teachers' shoulders, who have had no role almost in the recent changes in the education programs. And all these are not very good signs for me.
You say that works are canaries, works of fiction are canaries in the coal mine. You've picked three books to concentrate on in this particular book, Huckleberry Finn of Mark Twain, Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis, and The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by Carson McCullers. You also talk a little bit about the work of James Baldwin at the end. How are those works and those authors, how are they canaries in the coal mine?
I don't like to use the word attack or assault all the time, but that is what comes to my mind. On individual rights and on human rights manifests itself in attacks on usually the rights of women and minorities and culture. They become the first victims or the first points of focus. And what I wanted to remind people, especially because of my experiences of traveling around this country and finding so many passionate and committed both citizens and readers, what I wanted to remind them of were that these novels not only reflect the kind of reality that we live in, but they are also sort of like our moral guardians, reminding us that this society was based on taking risks, on actualization of a dream, on people having a passion. And it was also based on a very interactive relationship between society and the individual. And if we withdraw from the public sphere, if we do not focus on connecting to society through what we are most passionate about, what fulfills us, and if we do not critically appraise those who are supposed to represent us, we will lose a great deal of the values that this society has offered us. And you can see it with the first book that I mentioned in that in Republic of Imagination, which is Mark Twain's Huck Finn, of course.
All three books, it seems to me, have a lot to do with rebellion and people, you know, going against the body politic in a lot of ways. Of course, picking just three is an almost an impossible task. But did you come up with these three because of their common thread?
Yes, and you know, at first I had started with 24 books. That was the outline I gave my editor at the beginning. But then I realized that if I want to do justice to these 24 books, then I have to write several volumes. And what I should do is focus on the themes and pick up books that best represent these themes. And what I see is that I see in Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn a sort of literary declaration of independence. He creates characters that are completely new. You know, Europe has all these cultural and literary traditions. You know, we don't have any Shakespeare's or Molière's or Dante's in this country. But Twain and other writers realize that they have something that no other country has. And that is this new perspective on the world. And the language that they use. Mark Twain was very sensitive about the use of language and the language that he uses for each of his characters and the way he subverts the language. These books are very subversive. And their first target, what they really are attacking, is this possibility and existence of conformity in a democracy, and in this case in the American society. And each time Huck and Jim land on the shore, where the shore is supposed to be a place of safety, but for them that civilization is so dangerous because they have to either disguise themselves or hide from it because it will kill them. So there is a great deal of violence in this form of conformity, and that is what Twain begins with and criticizes. and at the center of it is the individual, but not the individual who, like today, is after greed, and each of us should, you know, try to win the race and take it away from others. It is the kind of individual who experiences the other and understands the other and connects to the other, and that is Huck becomes a moral person through his interactions with Jim. And each of the other novels, including Baldwin's, that I talk about are concerned with this morality, which I think is the foundation of American democracy.
Azar Nafisi, thank you so much for your time. Happy Thanksgiving. You give us a lot to think about in both of these books, and certainly hope that you are feeling better soon. Thanks so much.
I feel better talking to you. Thank you so much, and happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
Thanks. Azar Nafisi, her latest book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. Azar Nafisi will be speaking at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road in North Baltimore next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning for a link to all the details. That'll do it for us this morning. We appreciate your listening, and we hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
We have production help from
Connor Graham,
Payam Agagasam,
and Elizabeth Sherwood.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
On this day in Maryland history, in 1783, Annapolis began serving as the nation's capital for 9 months. I'm Sheila Cast. Happy Thanksgiving.